Joanna was awakened by the gentle touch of sunlight upon her cheek. Opening her sleep-swollen eyes, she was at once alarmed.
Oh!
He was gone. She stared at the empty space where he had made his bed. He had told her that he was on his way to Montana. Evidently, he didn't care to have the bother of a woman with him. Almost in a panic at this point, she flung the blanket from her, frantic to see whether he had left her a horse to ride. In her haste, she tripped over a fold in her blanket, fell to her knees, and scrambled up to her feet again, only to discover the horse is gone. She almost cried out in anguish, but she stifled the cry in her throat when she saw Clint just beyond the willows, leading the horses up from the river. Feeling awkward and foolish, she returned to fold her blanket, hoping he had not witnessed her panic.
Morning.
Good morning.
You were sleeping so soundly I didn't have the heart to wake you. You feeling strong enough to ride?
Yes.
If you're needing some privacy to do whatever you gotta do, there's a pretty thick stand of fir trees beyond those willows. I'll be making us some coffee while you're gone.
When she returned, he could see that she had freshened her face and tried to comb her hair with her fingers. He stopped what he was doing to examine her face in the early morning sunlight.
Worked you over pretty good, didn't they? I believe a little bit of the swelling's gone down, though.
He gave her a warm smile then.
You're gonna have a black eye for a day or two.
She smiled, almost blushing in her embarrassment, knowing how she had mistrusted his motive for rescuing her, and then thinking he had deserted her. She knew then, looking into his rugged and honest face, that she could trust him with her life as well as her honor, an honor that now seemed deemed worthless. She felt compelled to apologize.
I owe you an apology, Clint.
For what?
For being so much trouble. And I want to thank you again, sincerely, for what you did.
No trouble at all. I'm on my way to Montana, and I ain't on any time schedule to get there.
He gave her a reassuring smile, relieved to see that she had gained control of her crying fits.
If we're going to get you home again, I need to know how long you've been gone and from what direction you came from. When I first spotted you, you were heading straight west. Did they bring you most of the time in that direction?
Yes.
How many days did you travel?
It seemed like an eternity. It was, 3 nights before the night you came.
Can you tell me anything more about it? Flatland, hills, mountains, rivers?
Our house is in the mountains. When they took me, we left the mountains, but rode through some smaller mountains before we reached the prairie where you found us. Oh, and we crossed a river before we got into the smaller mountains.
That told Clint that it was going to be one hell of a challenge to find the stream she had described, or even the area of the mountains her home was in. He had never been in the Black Hills, but he had heard tales about them from his father. Tall, rugged mountains covered with evergreen trees, meadow-like valleys of grass leading to rocky gulches. The Sioux called them Pahasapa and considered them to be the center of the world. According to the treaties, white men weren't even supposed to go there.
Tell me about the river.
I remember we crossed a river where it looked like it forked with another river. My hands and feet were tied to the horse, and I was afraid I was going to drown if the water got too deep. It wasn't very deep, though.
With no more information than that, he figured the only plan left to him was to head southeast to pick up the Indians' trail where he had first encountered them.
We'll start out to the east as soon as you eat something. I know your family is worried about you.
After a ride of 5 or 6 miles, Clint recognized the low line of hills from which he had watched the raiding party. But it was the middle of the day before he found their tracks. Kneeling beside the trail, he looked back toward the east and the blue-black silhouette of the hills in the distance.
I reckon home is that way. We'll be lucky to reach those hills before dark.
Forced to circle back when he lost the trail at the head of a wide ravine, he had to slow down to make sure he didn't repeat the mistake. Knowing the horses would have to rest soon, he looked ahead, hoping to see a line of trees or shrubs that would indicate the presence of a stream, but he saw no sign.
Clint?
When he turned toward her, he saw her looking off to her right. Following the line of sight, he spotted half a dozen Indians on a mesa some 700 or 800 yards distant, their ponies in a single line, motionless as they watched the white man and woman passing toward the mountains. It was at least 3 miles to the foothills they'd been riding toward, and it appeared the warriors had the angle and could easily cut them off before they reached those hills. To make matters worse, the horses were tired and in no shape for an extended gallop.
Just keep riding. We'll get as far as we can before they decide to jump us.
Maybe they haven't seen us.
Maybe.
Clint knew they'd have to be blind not to. He held Rowdy to a slow, leisurely pace, hoping the Indians would hold off long enough for him to find some form of cover. He saw very little as he scanned the treeless terrain before him. The line of warriors on the ridge turned, and keeping pace with him, paralleled his path. Like him, they were still deciding where best to engage the enemy. Holding steady to the trail, he'd been backtracking all morning. He finally decided that he wasn't going to find any better place to defend than the shallow ravine he was approaching. He figured the 6 warriors weren't going to let him reach the foothills, now less than 2.5 miles away, so he decided to take his stand in the ravine.
This is as good a place as any. We'll lead the horses down to the bottom, and I can get up behind those rocks on the rim with my rifle.
Shouldn't we try to reach the hills?
They're not going to let us reach them. And this is the best place between here and the hills.
Well, maybe they're friendly. They haven't done anything but follow us.
If they were friendly, they would have most likely have rode on down to meet us.
He guided Rowdy down into the ravine. It seemed to be a signal for the Sioux, because they stopped and appeared to be discussing a plan of attack. After a few minutes, they turned their ponies down the slope and spread out in a fan-like formation, gradually picking up speed as they descended the ridge. Clint had hoped they'd stay more bunched up. Dismounting, he led the horses to the bottom of the ravine.
There ain't nothing to tie the horses to. We don't want them to get scared by the shooting and run off. Can you hold them?
She nodded, but she didn't show a great deal of confidence.
You can do it. Just sit down here on the ground and hold on to the buckskin and the paint strings. I'm going to be busy up on the side, but I'll keep an eye on you. I'm going to get you home safe.
Figuring he had 5 or 10 minutes before they were in rifle range, he used the time to fill his pockets with extra cartridges and load the Henry, as well as his Winchester. Taking another look at Joanna, he felt reasonably sure that she was out of harm's way, provided he could hold the warriors at bay. As an extra precaution, however, he pulled her father's shotgun from the pack and loaded it. He handed it to her, along with his pistol.
If something happens to me, use the shotgun first, then the pistol. But I don't plan on you having to use them at all.
With time running short, he scrambled up the side of the ravine to take his place behind a waist-high rock. Satisfied that he had a field of fire covering 180 degrees, he laid the Henry on top of the rock, where it'd be handy if he got caught with not enough time to reload his Winchester. Ready for the assault, he waited. After glancing briefly at the woman sitting at the bottom of the ravine to make sure she was all right, he shifted his gaze quickly back to the warriors now bearing down on him. He was confident with his accuracy with his rifle, but he waited for the Sioux warriors to advance to within 100 yards, knowing he couldn't miss at that distance, even with a moving target. The warriors were not as patient, though, and they opened fire when still a good way beyond that distance. Clint watched the progress of the charging warriors, anticipating their plan of assault. It was obvious to him that the 4 near the center of their arc were intent upon laying down a blistering rain of fire to keep them pinned down, while the 2 at each end hoped to flank them or even circle behind them. With that in mind, the first targets he selected were the flanking riders. He'd be in serious trouble if they got behind him. When the Indians reached the spot on the prairie he had mentally selected, he rose slightly and unhurriedly took careful aim. The warrior on the left flank tumbled from the saddle, Without hesitation, but with no haste, he turned and sighted on the rider on the opposite flank with the same result. The sudden deadly response stopped the warrior's charge, causing the four remaining to scatter for safety. Acting quickly now, Clint knocked two more of the raiders out of their saddles before they were able to retreat. The last two galloped away to safety. He figured the Sioux warriors wouldn't try that again, but he knew you could never be sure about Indians. So while there was time, he hurried down the slope to Joanna.
Get mounted. We got some time now to reach those hills.
As soon as he secured the extra weapons, he led her out of the ravine and headed toward the hills to the east. The horses still needed rest, but he figured he would take care of that as soon as they reached the security of the foothills. Having been unable to see what was taking place above her, Joanna was startled to see the bodies scattered about in the sage and short prairie grass. She had only heard four shots from his rifle, and she counted four bodies. Two of the riderless horses stood watching them while the other two galloped off in the general direction the retreating Sioux had taken. The two Indian ponies that remained followed along behind them for a few hundred yards before stopping to watch the two riders. Clint pulled up and turned back to look at the Indian ponies. Though he hadn't wished to be burdened with extra horses before, it now occurred to him that it would be worth the trouble for a start in Montana.
Wait here.
Clint rode back to the standing horses. He had a hunch that if he led one of them, a mare, that the other would follow. So using the reins as a rope, he slipped them around the mare's neck and tied the other end to his pack horse. The mare went along obediently, and after hesitating to make up its mind, the other horse followed the mare. He caught up with Joanna again.
Might as well start building the herd.
Carl Steiner stood beside the grave of his beloved wife, Sarah. He was still unable to look at the grave without seeing images of her crushed skull, but he needed to talk to someone about the feelings that were troubling his mind.
I miss you so much, darling. I don't know if I can make it without you.
He turned to look back at the cabin to make sure Robert couldn't hear him.
I'm going to go look for Joanna if I have to search every Sioux camp in the territory.
He paused to think about what he had just vowed. Robert was not set on venturing out to Powder River country. Maybe he was right. Maybe it was suicide. Carl couldn't sit there and do nothing when his daughter was a captive in some Indian village, if in fact she was still alive. It was hard to know what to do. Robert was right about one thing. There were so many Indian camps and villages in the Powder River Valley alone that odds were astronomical they would happen upon the one where Joanna was held. But his daughter had always been a spunky girl, even as a child, and he had a small glimmer of hope that she might escape her captors and return home. This slim possibility was the only reason Carl was still delaying his search for her. Morning brought a chilly breeze sweeping across the eastern slopes of the mountains. Robert was up early and packing his saddlebags when Carl came out to find him.
Morning. You're up early. You think it's time we went looking for Joanna?
His pack ready, Robert turned to Carl.
I'm thinking it's time I went back to Omaha.
What are you talking about?
I'm going back home. We've both lost our wives, and there ain't no sense in staying out in these godforsaken mountains any longer waiting to get scalped. You're welcome to go with me, but I'm aiming to leave this morning.
But Joanna's still out there somewhere. We'll find her.
Carl, we don't know she's even alive. The chances are she ain't.
But we have to look for her.
Even if we found her, she ain't the same woman that left here. God knows how many savages she's been forced to lay with since she's been gone. You know that.
I don't know any such thing.
Robert stepped up in the saddle. And with eyes cold and unfeeling, he stared down at his father-in-law.
You coming or not?
Hell no! I ain't coming with you, you sorry dog. Go on, get the hell away from here. I always knew Joanna was too good for the likes of you.
I'm sorry, Carl, but there ain't nothing here for me no more. No hard feelings, though?
Get the hell gone before I get my gun and shoot your sorry ass!
Carl watched his son-in-law ride out of the clearing, feeling like the last man left on the face of the earth. A uniformed guard tapped lightly on the office door before opening it far enough to stick his head through.
Clayton's here, Warden.
Warden Nathaniel K. Boswell looked up from his desk.
Well, tell him to come on in.
He leaned back in his chair in amused anticipation of the deputy marshal's report. Deputy Marshal Zach Clayton strode into the office. The trace of chagrin he wore on his face bore proof that he knew full well the reception awaiting him, and Boswell did not disappoint.
Howdy, Zach. I hear tell you've taken to riding the train lately. Have a seat. I heard you've been doing a little walking, too.
Boswell could not suppress all of the grin that threatened to spread across his whole face. He could well imagine the embarrassment for Clayton following his encounter with the escaped felons, resulting in his having to walk to Cheyenne, then take the train back to Laramie. Zach Clayton was a proud man, although he'd never admit it. Clayton and Boswell had known each other for a number of years, from the time when Boswell was a sheriff. He knew before he walked in that his old friend was going to ride him hard for this one.
Yeah, Nat, I reckon you can crow a little about this one, but it ain't over yet.
According to your telegram, you had one of them, but you let him get away and leave you on foot. How'd that happen?
Clayton smirked and rubbed the healing cut on his chin.
He was very persuasive. So I told him to go along, and I just walked back to Cheyenne. Hell, it wasn't but 15 miles.
He went on to tell Boswell how he had happened to ride into the ambush with Ballinger and Yancey.
As for young Connor, that's a hard one to figure out. If he hadn't jumped those two from behind and run them off, I might still be pinned down behind my horse. It's hard to arrest a man after he's just saved your bacon. But I took the oath, so I arrested him. And then I let them get the jump on me.
Got any ideas about Ballinger and that other fella? Where might they be headed?
None at all. They could be heading anywhere, but I'd bet on Montana territory. Bozeman or Helena, most likely. They'll show up before long, rob a bank or hold up a stage, and then I'll be right behind them.
Zach, we could turn this over to another marshal in Montana.
Hell no. I'll run those bastards down if I have to go to Canada to catch them. I ain't ever quit on a job. I'll catch young Connor, too. Might be a little harder to run down because he ain't likely to rob no banks or nothing. He just wants to lose himself somewhere. One of these days he'll turn around. I'll be standing there.
All right, that's what you've set your mind to do. But, Zach, that country's dangerous right now. You watch yourself.
Joanna Becker knelt beside the gently flowing creek, trying to see her reflection in the water. It was not dark enough to reflect a clear image, giving her a distorted picture of her battered face. Much of the tenderness had gone from the bruises left by the brutal, wide-shouldered savage, but she feared the cut on one side of her face would leave a scar. What would Robert think?
He'll understand.
She continued to stare into the water, touching her bruised face lightly with her fingertips. The touch caused her to shiver when she remembered the abuse that had brought about her wounds. She vowed that she would never tell her husband the full extent of her abuse. It might break his heart. She looked up from the creek to glance at the stranger who had rescued her and protected her. She thanked God for Clint Connor, marveling that he would interrupt his life to see her safely home. She also thanked God for the man's decency. Out in these mountains, removed from all civilization, he could easily have used her and abandoned her, and no one would ever have known. But she had learned that Clint was a man of integrity and honor, a man she could put all her trust in. Reminding herself that she should help him break camp, she quickly splashed water on her face and smoothed her hair back. She couldn't block the thought that crept in as she patted her face dry.
He's seeing me at my very worst.
She was well aware that she was not really a pretty woman, but she knew that she was not truly homely either.
Just plain.
She scolded herself for even wondering whether it mattered how she looked to Clint as she walked back from the creek.
I expect we best get going if you're ready.
I'm ready. I'll just rinse out the coffee pot and put out the fire.
Looking over the saddle as he tightened Rowdy's cinch, Clint watched her as she hurried about the campfire. He couldn't help but admire her spirit after what she had suffered. She had tried not to be a burden to him. Last night, she had insisted that she should prepare their supper, and she had mixed up some pan biscuits with the flour he had brought from his father's house. They were pretty good, too.
Her husband's a lucky man.
Once in the saddle again, they started out following the creek through a series of foothills. Clint first, leading his pack horse, and Joanna coming on behind. The prior 2 days had been spent tracing various springs and streams through the mountains in hopes that they would lead to some place Joanna recognized. None had. But the creek they were now on was only a few hundred yards from its confluence with a river that Joanna guessed might be the Beaver. Upon reaching the river, there was a question as to the proper direction to turn, north or south, in hopes of finding the forks that she remembered crossing when abducted.
I'm sorry. I honestly don't know.
Clint nodded patiently and stood up in the stirrups to look around them.
Judging from the direction of their trail before we lost it back there, I'd say we need to go south.
He turned Rowdy in that direction. Riding with the dark outline of the Black Hills on their left, they had progressed no more than 2 or 3 miles when Joanna spurred her horse up beside him.
There! There's the fork with this river. I remember that.
There were more than a few game trails leading down from the mountains to the river. They all looked the same to Joanna. She could not say which trail was the one her abductors had taken down to the river. Clint examined each likely prospect for sign, but could find none. Finally, he decided to follow the one that looked the most used, and they started up through the pines. It was late in the afternoon when the trail turned and led them back toward the river. The second trail they picked seemed more promising when it led up over a small ridge and then took them down into a long, narrow gulch that cut deeply into the mountains.
Oh, we came this way!
The gray rocky walls closed in to form a narrow passageway, and memories of that dark, horrible night returned to her. Her throat tightened as she recalled those terrifying moments.
Well, that's good. We'll have you home soon, and you'll be back with your husband and your father.
She pointed up the trail.
It's not far now, just on the other side of that ridge.
The worry of seconds before was replaced by the anticipation of her reunion with her husband and father, and she pushed ahead of Clint, anxious to go home. Carl Steiner looked over the supplies he had gathered to take with him. They seemed meager to set out with on a trip that could last for a long, long time. Seeing the small quantity of flour and coffee beans made him even angrier.
I should have opened those packs that son of a bitch had on his horse. He damn sure took a generous share.
He paused to listen when his horse whinnied in the corral, but he made no effort to investigate until he suddenly heard a horse lope into the clearing. He dropped the sack of coffee beans and grabbed the rifle propped against the table. Running to slam the open door, he was stopped in his tracks, hardly believing his eyes.
Papa!
Joanna slid from her horse and started running up to him. He stepped outside just as she reached him and gave him a hug.
Oh, baby girl!
He looked at his daughter's bruised and swollen face, and then he pulled her close in his arms.
Oh, you're home. You're home.
Still holding his daughter tightly, He glanced up to discover a man slowly walking his horse into the clearing.
Who is that?
Oh, Clint Connor. He's the reason I'm back home safe.
Releasing him then, she looked into her father's eyes.
Where's Robert? At the claim?
The moment of joy for Carl was suddenly lost, replaced by one of reluctance. She saw the baleful look in her father's eyes.
What? Is Robert all right?
Knowing of no way to tell her that would not devastate her, he just came out with it.
Robert's not here. He packed up and went back east.
What? Why?
Why? I don't know. Because he ain't fit to wear men's clothes. It's good riddance, I say. I was going to go search for you again, but he wouldn't even do that.
He held her by her shoulders and looked into her eyes.
It's better you found out what he was made of now instead of later on.
Joanna was staggered, her brain reeling as much as it did from the physical blows she suffered from the broad-shouldered warrior. She felt all the blood drain from her head, and she had to sink to the ground to keep from fainting. With the unspeakable abuse she had endured, she expected to need some time for herself to recover. But if she never spoke of these things, she had hoped Robert would understand, never question her, press her for details. There had never been any thought that he might abandon her. It was not her fault she was abducted. How could Robert blame her and look upon her as soiled? He didn't even wait around to find out for sure. A silent observer to the tragic homecoming, Clint found himself furious for Joanna. In the few days they had traveled together, he had known her to be a fine and decent woman and deserving of an understanding husband. As his fury subsided, he felt a wave of compassion for the jilted woman, but there was nothing he could think of to alleviate her pain. So he left the grieving father and daughter to their sorrow without the intrusion of his presence. Later, as he was checking the buckskin's front hooves, he heard Carl Steiner coming up behind him. He stood up to face him.
Mr. Connor.
Carl extended his hand.
Clint.
They shook.
Clint, I apologize for my lack of hospitality, but it was a bad time for my daughter. I had to tell her some bad things.
Yes, sir. I couldn't help but overhear. I'm real sorry for Joanna. She deserves better. I'm sorry about your wife, too. I expect I'd best get along and let you folks have your privacy.
Oh, no, sir, I wouldn't hear of it. Joanna told me what you did for her, and for me. I have you to thank for giving me back my daughter. No, sir, I insist you stay with us. Joanna's strong. She's in the house now, starting supper, and she would never forgive you if you didn't stay.
I don't want to be in the way with her feeling so bad right now.
Clint, she wants you to stay. She feels she owes you for her life. Hell, I owe you for bringing my daughter back. Anything you want that I can give, I owe you.
Clint nodded his surrender.
A cup of coffee will do, I reckon.
Well, I can certainly manage that. Put your horses in the corral with mine and come on in the house.
As soon as her father left to go talk to Clint, Joanna had gone to her room and changed out of the dirty, torn dress she had been wearing ever since she was taken. She told herself to be strong, that she could live with the stigma of being discarded, and she was determined to show a strong resolve for Clint's sake. She was burning the dirty dress in the fireplace when the men came in. It could have been washed and mended, but she would never wear that dress again. And she didn't want it around to remind her.
Oh, I hope that wasn't supper.
Clint got a glimpse of the material he had been seeing every day and knew at once the significance of the cremation. Joanna glanced in his direction, but would not meet his gaze, lest he saw the redness from crying. There were so many things troubling her mind. Her mother's death, her captivity, her husband's desertion. But she was determined to remain strong at this moment. There would be time later, when alone in her bed, when she could succumb to her grief.
Sit down, Clint. I'll get you some coffee and food.
As it turned out, Clint had to settle for biscuits and beans. Carl apologized after the supper was finished.
I'm afraid I haven't been thinking much about fresh meat for a while.
I reckon that's understandable. That's one thing I can do for you. I'll go hunting in the morning. Lord knows I saw plenty of sign on the way in.
Clint and Joanna's father remained seated at the table drinking coffee. After listening to Joanna's account of the days following her rescue until they showed up here at the cabin, Carl began to tell Clint about his journey from Germany when Joanna was a baby. And before he wound down, he had taken Clint through every phase of his and his family's life, from New York to Missouri to Omaha, and finally to this cabin in the Black Hills. Halfway through, Clint caught Joanna's gaze. She rolled her eyes heavenward as a sign of boredom. Clint smiled at her, understanding the old man's need to talk about the past.
I guess I've been doing all the talking. I must apologize.
Quite all right.
What about you, Clint? Joanna said you were on your way to Montana.
That's a fact.
Where in Montana?
Can't say for sure. I reckon I'll know when I find it.
You got family?
Nope. Just my pa back in Cheyenne.
What are you planning on doing when you get to Montana?
Papa, for goodness sake, let the poor man drink his coffee. You'll wear him out with your questions.
Her father jerked his head back with a mock expression of surprise.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be nosy.
He winked at Clint, then turned to Joanna.
I had already been thinking about pulling out of here myself, even before those savages ran off with you. I hadn't said anything to Robert about it, but I was thinking about going up to the Yellowstone with your Uncle Frederick. That's why I was interested in what part of Montana Clint was heading for. We weren't scraping enough gold out of the stream to buy salt and flour, and Frederick has always tried to get me to join him up there.
He glanced over at Clint then.
My younger brother went out to Montana with two other families a year ago. They're farming a strip of land on the lower side of the Yellowstone River, where the Tongue River connects with it. I thought if you were going up Montana way, it might be a good time for us to pull up stakes and go with you. As far as the Yellowstone, anyway. There isn't a hell of a lot of summer left, so I was thinking I'd better get going if we're going to do it. I think it would be better for Joanna, too, to be around other folks instead of wasting away up here with an old man. Of course, you might not want any company.
It's fine with me. I think you're asking for more trouble if you stay here in these mountains by yourself.
Clint was actually relieved to know that Joanna would not be at the mercy of any roving Sioux raiding parties that happened upon the isolated cabin. Equally relieved, Joanna smiled her approval. The next few days were spent in preparation for the journey north. It could have been done more quickly, but for the need for fresh meat. So Clint spent one day hunting in the mountain ridges for deer. Since he planned to smoke the meat to preserve it, he passed up a shot at a 10-point buck in favor of a medium-sized one. He wanted a deer that was in good condition without much fat. The less fat, the better and quicker the meat would dry. Back at the cabin, he and Carl cut four forked steaks to support the drying frame they fashioned. Then, the venison was cut in strips to hang from racks made from tree limbs over a fire pit dug in the yard. One whole day was required to properly dry the jerky, but there was enough to last them for the journey to Montana. When all was ready to depart, Carl closed the door to the cabin that had been his family's home for only 8 months. He and Joanna made one last visit to the grave of his late wife before stepping up in the saddle. There were no happy memories left there by him or his daughter as they followed Clint up the side of the ridge, each rider leading a pack horse loaded with the earthly possessions of all three. With no real knowledge of the country they had set out to cross, they went back in the general direction Clint and Joanna had come from when he brought her home. Reaching the Belle Fourche, they decided to follow the course that Clint had originally picked before his encounter with Joanna's abductors.
I figured on holding to a north and slightly west trail. figured I had to hit the Yellowstone somewhere. Once we strike the Yellowstone, I reckon we'll have to figure out which way to go to find your brother's place.
Less than a day's ride found him on the banks of another river. Recollecting the planned route that his brother had told him about back in Omaha, Carl speculated that it might be the Powder River, and he knew that the place his brother described was at the confluence of the Tongue and the Yellowstone.
If we keep bearing to the west, we'll reach the Tongue River. Then we can follow it north to the Yellowstone.
That suits me just fine. I never seen any of this country before.
They camped by the river that night and started out on a more westerly course the next morning. A little before the sun was directly overhead, they came upon a trail apparently left by an entire village of Indians on the move. The trail led directly from the west, causing Clint and Carl to decide it best to turn a little more north so as not to chance overtaking them. Stopping only long enough to rest the horses, they pushed on until nightfall, crossing several other trails of smaller Indian parties heading west. As the sun settled lower in the prairie to the west, they spotted another river by the line of trees in the distance.
I was hoping we'd come upon a stream or river or something before dark.
Maybe I better ride on ahead and take a look around before we go riding into those trees. As much Indian sign as we've seen today, I wouldn't be surprised if there was someone else camping there already.
Might not be a bad idea. Joanna and I will stay back here below this ridge till you call us in.
With his rifle cradled across his arms, Clint held Rowdy to a comfortable lope until he reached the edge of a line of cottonwoods that bordered a river. Walking the buckskin slowly through the brush and trees, he looked the bank over for the best place to camp. He had just about settled upon a spot when he noticed that Rowdy's ears, seldom still, were now pricked up as if he heard something.
I best take a look.
He dismounted, looped Rowdy's reins over a berry bush, and with his rifle ready, he walked farther along the bank. By then, the approaching evening dusk had descended upon the riverbank, and the daylight faded away, affording him the cover of darkness. He'd walked no more than a few dozen yards when he discovered the cause of Rowdy's concern. Through the trees that skirted the water, he saw the faint flicker of a flame. Before moving any closer, he paused to check the wind. Concerned that a horse might announce his presence, he determined that he was downwind, so he kept moving forward until he reached a large cottonwood that afforded ample cover while giving him a better look at the camp. He was immediately relieved to see only two horses and apparently just one man sleeping on the other side of a small campfire. From the look of things, he wasn't sure whether he was an Indian or not. He considered whether he should hail the camp or go back and get his horse and then ride in. Even if he was a white man, Clint had no way of knowing what manner of man would be traveling through Indian country alone. Maybe it might be wiser to go back for Carl and Joanna, then move downriver a mile or so and let this traveler be. Making his way through the darkened trees, he returned to his horse to find Rowdy still fidgeting nervously.
It's just me, boy. Looks like a peaceful traveler. We'll just let him be.
I'm right glad to hear that, friend.
Clint whirled at once, his rifle before him, searching for the source of the words.
Take her easy there. You ain't got nothing to fear from me.
Although he couldn't tell which tree the man was behind, Clint relaxed his defensive stance. He figured if whoever it was intended to shoot him, he would already have done so. As soon as he did, a gnarled little knot of a man stepped out from behind a tree, dressed head to foot in buckskins. He carried a Remington rolling block rifle, and when he rested the butt on the ground, the muzzle of the long, heavy barrel was even with his shoulder. As speechless as if a gnome or a forest spirit had suddenly materialized from the darkness, Clint just stood gaping at the little man.
I seen you when you was riding across the ridge back yonder. But these days, it's a good idea to check on who's checking on you. So I circled back around here while you were taking a look at my camp.
I reckon that's fair enough.
What in tarnation are you doing out here? Ain't you heard about Little Bighorn?
No. What about it?
The elfish little man explained that there had been a terrible battle on the Little Bighorn, and that Colonel George Custer had suffered a massacre. Though mildly shocked by the news, Clint figured there was nothing he could do about it now.
My name's Clint Connor. I got a couple of friends back yonder behind that last ridge. A man and his daughter. We were fixing to make camp on our way to Yellowstone country.
Billy Turnipseed!
The little man stepped forward to shake Clint's hand.
Go on back and get your friends. You're welcome at my campfire. I done it, but I'd be proud to boil you some coffee. If I had some coffee beans. You ain't got some by chance, have you?
Yeah, we got some coffee. I'll go fetch my friends.
Clint slipped his rifle back in the saddle sling and stepped up on Rowdy.
I'm thinking you might be that fella that shot them engines over near the Belle Fouche. I heard that Red Hand said that man rode a buckskin horse like this one and had a woman with him.
Clint checked the big horse momentarily, wondering whether that might change things.
They said he had a spirit gun that didn't miss.
Billy turned to go to his camp.
Go get your folks. We'll drink some coffee. I ain't had no coffee in a long time.
When Clint led Carl and Joanna into the little clearing by the riverbank, Billy Turnipseed had recharged his fire and moved his saddle back away from it. After introductions were made, Clint and Carl took care of the horses while Joanna ground some coffee beans, and soon the coffee pot was boiling away. Although Billy had already eaten, he reconsidered and accepted Joanna's offer to share their supper. She made a thick soup by boiling some of the deer jerky with dried beans, thickened with a small amount of flour. It was good eating, Billy testified. While they sat around the fire, finishing the coffee, Billy told them how he happened to be a lone trapper and hunter in the midst of several Indian tribes that were growing more and more hostile.
I've rode up the Powder River Valley, up and down, back and forth, for over 15 years by my calculations. At least as nigh as I can remember. I've trapped over as far as Three Forks, up the Milk and Muscle Shell, and the Missouri as far as Fort Benton. But mostly, I've been after buffalo for the last few years.
How is it you don't have any trouble with the Indians?
Oh, I get along just fine with the Indians. Lived with them for a few years. Old Angry Bears Lakotas. They even give me a name. Sungmahitu.
What's it mean?
Coyote! Well, old Angry Bear said I weren't much bigger than a coyote, but I could take a buffalo down just the same.
Clint found the spry little man entertaining with his shaggy beard draped across his wrinkled face from ear to ear like a tablecloth spread over a knotty oak table.
Don't the Sioux resent you killing buffalo?
No, not me. They know I just kill what I need to get by. I ain't doing it to sell the hides.
He winked at Joanna.
Every once in a while, though, I take a couple extra hides to swap for coffee and tobacco.
Which way are you heading?
South. Going to Fort Laramie. Maybe trade them hides you seen under my blanket.
Clint explained to Carl and Joanna that Billy had placed his blanket over a bundle of hides to make it look like a man sleeping while he circled around to Clint's horse.
Well, I didn't know how friendly you folks were.
Maybe you can give us a little help. None of us know the country we're riding through. We camped last night on a river. Took us all day to get here. Is this the Powder?
You really don't know where in the bejesus you are, do you? No, son, this ain't the Powder. This is the Little Powder. Well, that river you camped on last night, I expect, is the Little Missouri. You say you're trying to get to Yellowstone?
Where it meets the Tongue.
What do you want to go there for?
My brother and some other families are farming some land near there.
Yeah. Well, you best follow this river north. It'd take you about 2 days before you come to the fork where this meets up with the Powder. Well, you could cut across northwest from there, because you want to strike the Tongue and follow that on in. I ought to tell you, though, after you leave the fork at the Powder, you strike a fair-sized creek in about half a day. You might want to follow that creek for another half a day or so before you go west again to strike the Tongue. There's a lot of engine going on in that country right now. There's a whole village of engines scattered in all directions since the fight at Littlehorn. You folks best keep a sharp eye on where you're going, because they ain't too friendly to white folks.
Billy cocked an eye in Clint's direction.
Especially one that's killed four of Red Hand's warriors. Now, I expect Red Hand's already looking for you. Now, I noticed the lady rode in sitting on an engine saddle, and I guess that three of them horses is engine ponies. They ain't wearing no shoes! So you keep your eyes open, son, and keep that Winchester you're toting ready to use.
With the dawning of a new day, they bid farewell to Billy Coyote Turnipseed and followed the Little Powder north. The strange little man left, happily carrying a small sack of coffee beans given him by Joanna after warning Clint once again to be careful. Heeding Billy's advice, Clint kept an observant eye out as he made their way north. They rode close by the river, since it was the quickest cover available in case of an encounter with hostiles, but they saw no sign of Indian activity all day long. Just as Billy Turnipseed had said, they came to the fork of the Little Powder and the Powder in the afternoon of the second day. There were plenty of signs that a fairly large village of Indians had recently camped there. They were obviously moving fast because there were no signs of teepee rings, but there were many cook fires.
It wasn't too long ago.
Clint examined the ashes in one of the fires.
I expect if we'd gotten here the day before yesterday, we might have been invited for supper.
We might have been supper. I'm just as glad we're late.
Carl glanced at Joanna. Her tight frown told him that she was not ready to joke about anything to do with the Sioux.
There's still a lot of daylight left. Maybe we could keep moving and hope to strike that creek he told us about before dark.
Lying flat on his belly on the grass-covered crest of a long mesa, Clint watched the procession of Lakota men, women, and children on the opposite bank of the creek. At a distance of approximately 300 yards, he could count 22 horses with 8 male riders and maybe 5 female. Walking along with the rest of the pony herd were a number of women and children.
Are they still heading off to the northeast?
That was the general direction of most of the Indian trails they had crossed during the past 2 days.
Nope. They started following the creek.
Clint looked up at the fading afternoon light.
I expect they're getting ready to make camp. We best cut around this mesa and strike the creek a mile or two north of the camp.
They continued north, following the creek until darkness threatened to overtake them. They selected a spot where a stand of willows and berry bushes provided a suitable screen from any chance riders that happened by. Supper was the same as every night before since leaving the cabin, beans boiled with some of the deer jerky. Clint would have killed fresh meat, but for the presence of so much Indian sign. In fact, they continued to come upon so many recent trails of Indians on the move that Joanna approached Clint with a request before they went to sleep that night.
I want you to let me have that pistol you left with me when the savages attacked us in the ravine.
Why, sure. I'd have given it to you before if I knew you wanted to tote a gun.
He went at once to get it from his saddlebag. Upon returning with the weapon, he checked the cylinder.
It's loaded with 5 cartridges. It's sitting on an empty cylinder. Just cock it and she's ready.
He gazed into her eyes as she took the revolver, reading the deep determination registered there. And immediately, he felt the hurt in her heart. She didn't request the weapon for the sole purpose of helping to ward off an Indian attack. He wished that he could promise her that he would not let anything happen to her. But he knew that she wanted the pistol to ensure that she would never be taken alive by hostiles again.
I'll get you to your folks.
She nodded, then withdrew to her blanket. The night passed without incident, and respecting Billy Turnipseed's advice, they continued north along the creek for another day before striking due west to find the Tongue River. Once it was found, they followed the winding river through seemingly endless stretches of open prairie for 2 days before sighting what could be nothing but the Yellowstone in the distance. They discovered a rough shack on the south bank just before dusk, providing an immense sense of relief to see some sign of white men, even though a hand-painted sign nailed over the door proclaimed the building to be a saloon. The next order of business was to find Carl's brother.
I can go in and ask. A saloon ain't a fit place for a lady, so you and Joanna can wait out here.
All right, but don't go in there and start drinking, unless you bring me a bottle too.
I'm going in for directions only. We'll drink after we get where we're going.
What can I get you?
Information, hopefully. I'm looking for a man named Frederick Steiner.
The bartender, a short, heavy-set man, scratched his bald head while he tried to recollect.
I can't say I know the man.
He's supposed to have a place near here. I think there's a few families that claimed land to farm.
Well, if they're farming, it would have to be on this side of the river. The land on the other side ain't much fit for farming.
There were a couple of men drinking at the rough plank bar when Clint walked in, and they had paused to listen to the conversation. One of them, a coarse-looking man with a face full of whiskers, wearing 2 6 guns with the handles facing forward, spoke up then.
You might be looking for that group of German folks that moved onto some land east of Wolf Creek.
Well, that sounds like the folks I'm looking for.
I can tell you how to get there. Just follow the river east past the trading posts. I'd say a good 4 or 5 miles. The first house is just on the other side of Wolf Creek. I think there are 3 houses all told, if I remember correctly. I ain't been over that way in about 6 months.
I'm obliged.
If you're driving a wagon, it might be rough going. You're going to have a slew of deep gullies to get around. Might be a little chancy in the dark.
No wagon.
Clint turned to leave.
Much obliged.
Once Clint reached the others, he mounted up and repeated the directions to Carl, who nodded slowly.
Ah, sounds like the place. Frederick said there were 3 families that started out from Omaha.
According to what that fella said, it's 4 or 5 miles to the first house, and we don't have any idea which house is your brother's. You want to try to find him tonight or wait till daylight?
It is getting pretty late. Might be best to make camp one more night and look for Frederick in the morning. How about it, Joanna? Think you can stand one more night on the trail?
I think it would be a lot better than rousting everybody out in the middle of the night, since Uncle Frederick doesn't even know we're coming. Besides, we don't even know how to find his house. It could be any one of the 3.
All right.
Just then, the door opened, and the 2 strangers from inside the bar stepped out and stood lolling against the saloon door jams, watching the trio.
But I think we ought to ride on down the river a piece before we make camp.
After a mile or so, they made camp next to a clump of cottonwood trees that formed a screen around a grassy knoll. Joanna had built up a fire, and soon venison strips were cooking and coffee was in the pot. The conversation was light on this last night on the trail. The dangerous passage through the Powder River country was behind them, and spirits were high.
What are your plans now that we're almost there, Clint?
I'm not really sure. Like I said from the beginning, I want to see the territory. Maybe right onto the mountains west of here.
Oh, you ought to stay on here with us.
Oh, I don't know. I ain't much of a farmer.
I expect it wouldn't take a lot to show you how. I found out I'm a better farmer than a gold miner.
I think Clint still hears the call of the wild hawk. He wants to raise his horses and live the free life with no crops to look after or hold them in one spot.
Even though she believed it to be true, she wished it were not so. She felt safe when Clint was around.
Maybe. I got a long way to go before I can be thinking about raising horses. All I've got is Rowdy and those 3 Indian ponies, and Rowdy can't do much to make a herd. He's a gelding, so he don't even glance at that little mare. I think I got a lot of work ahead of me before I can call myself a wrangler.
The conversation changed to speculation about the morning when they would find Frederick's place, and after a while, Carl announced that he was turning in.
Well, tomorrow's a big day.
Carl moved a little away from the fire to make his bed, and Joanna and Clint decided they should follow Carl's lead. Moving off to the opposite side of the fire from the woman and her father, Clint rolled up in his blanket. Soon the camp was quiet, but Clint could not fall asleep. His senses told him all was not right, and he kept thinking about the two men at the saloon, especially the one who did all the talking. He had the look of a predator about him, and although he'd been friendly enough, Clint did not trust him. After a while, when the sense of alertness would not leave him, he crawled out of his blanket, pulled his rifle from his saddle sling, and walked back in the trees to check on the horses. Rowdy lowered his head and rubbed his muzzle on Clint's chest and received a scratching behind his ears in return. While Clint was stroking his horse's neck, Rowdy's ears suddenly pricked up. Always alert to the horse's warning signals, Clint quickly looked around him in the darkened grove of trees. He saw nothing at first glance. Then, a slight motion off to his left, like a fleeting shadow, caught his attention. He dropped to one knee. Peering into the dark shadows, he couldn't detect any movement, but he was sure that his eyes had not been playing tricks on him. Continuing to stare into the inky void, he began to inch toward the spot where he thought he had detected movement. He quickly dropped to one knee again when suddenly two shadows separated from the black tree trunks. He didn't have to guess who these visitors were. They moved toward the camp, moving as quickly as he could through the brush while making as little noise as possible. He hurried to overtake them, but they had already reached the sleeping figures by the fire before he cleared the trees. The sudden gunshot brought Carl and Joanna bolting up from their slumber.
Time to get up!
The man that did all the talking at the bar aimed his pistol toward the ground beside Carl.
Let's have a look at them packs. Might as well save us the trouble of going through them. Tell us where the money is, and maybe you'll live a little longer.
His partner, a tall, thin man, had set eyes upon Joanna.
And you might live a little longer than that, sweetheart.
Joanna pulled her blanket up close to her neck.
Where's the other one?
I'm right here, asshole.
The thin man took a couple of steps backward before dropping to the ground, shot through the heart. His partner immediately grabbed Joanna, pulled her to her feet, and held her before him with the barrel of his pistol pressed against her throat.
Now, damn you! Me and the little missy here is going back out of here real slow. Now, this here 44's got a hair trigger, so I wouldn't advise you to try nothing fancy.
Clint said nothing, but he put the rifle butt against his shoulder and took dead aim. He walked slowly forward, following his prey while the bearded one dragged Joanna away from the fire. The rifle never wavered as Clint stalked the man, who held Joanna tightly before him, keeping the gun pressed against her neck while trying to keep his head almost hidden by hers. Clint continued to stalk, waiting, his rifle aimed, until the man quickly looked behind him to see where he was going. It was only for an instant, but when he jerked his head back to watch Clint, he was met with a bullet that put a neat hole in the middle of his forehead. Joanna felt the pistol drop from her throat as the man dropped to the ground, killed instantly. As Clint walked up to make sure the second outlaw was dead, Joanna ran to him and threw her arms around him.
Oh, damn you! Oh, you could have killed me!
Still trying to control her emotions, she pressed her face against his chest, not sure whether to thank him or curse him for risking her life.
I knew I wouldn't miss.
Carl, still in a mild state of shock over the sudden chaos that interrupted his sleep, could do little more than gape at his daughter clinging to Clint so desperately.
What? Where did they...
That's the two fellers from back at the saloon.
Clint explained while totally aware of the young woman still pressing tightly against his body. Suddenly aware as well, Joanna released him and quickly backed away.
I'm sorry. I thought I was shot. I felt the bullet right next to my face.
That was a hell of a shot, a dangerous shot.
I knew I wouldn't miss. I couldn't let him back out of here with Joanna. They weren't planning on leaving any of us alive. They didn't wear masks or anything to keep us from seeing their faces.
He's right, Papa. They planned to kill us all.
15 minutes later, with Carl's help, Clint had dragged the bodies away from their camp and deposited them in a deep gully near the river. Now, Clint walked back along the river until he found the attackers' two horses tied in a clump of berry bushes.
Well, it ain't the way I was planning to build a herd. There ain't no use in leaving both of you behind, is there?